Hi, Internet. My name is John Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos. He actually got it right this time.
We can't do this to them every time.
Yeah, we can.
We repeat the name thing, and we repeat...
It's our thing. It's our running joke.
We make fun of me because I have a catchphrase.
Yes. Well, because I still don't...
I mean, that I think deserves more scrutiny than the name thing.
Let me see if I can do it. Welcome to Unboxing Story, where we unpack the fiction without the friction.
Yay.
Yeah, got it. There you go. I won't joke about it anymore.
That's Melissa. I don't know if you...
I did. I said my name.
Speaking of stream of consciousness, mine is going off of a cliff. We're not going to talk about Good Grief, which not many of you... Well, I don't know the reach of this press. I won't presume. But something that we came across at a local convention, the Bucks County Book Fest. And I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I should say I'm only halfway through it. But diving right into it, it's about, what do you think it's about? Maybe grief?
I didn't catch that at first because, you know, you're so used to hearing Charlie Brown say it as just like a kid phrase to say when you're bummed.
But it's an appropriate thing because how it unfurls itself is that Tony is a high school teacher who his brother, Nathan, has recently died of a drug overdose, a heroin overdose. And he's real messed up about it, understandably enough. But it kind of unpacks how this dynamic works to affect his relationships, his family,
his work,
and
his mental state.
And how his relationship with his brother has kind of defined all these different things in his life.
Yeah.
And the cover, which was as graphic designers of sorts, what it kind of caught our attention because it is a Michelangelo Ninja Turtles mask, and it sits in front of a ashtray with a cigarette being put out on it. I'm usually really upset at how literary fiction has the most abstract covers. Like, we did Native Son.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a very transgressive thing about a black man in the 30s in Chicago who commits a murder of a white woman and then later another murder. And there's all this, like, intrigue in it. And it has, like, what looks like a Cosby sweater on the cover.
Yeah.
And it's like, who,
it's like,
why?
What is this?
So it's, I feel like with literary fiction, they have one foot in each side. Either it's this, like, absurdly pop, like, Andy Warhol painting, or it's so dry because they went to, like, this is serious literature.
Yeah.
We're not going to have
people... some person on there with, like, bodice on or a shirtless dude or what
even,
else is on
cover. Even if all
time?
That stuff is in
even
the book.
Even if that stuff is in the book. Don't matter. You're not putting it on a cover.
But one of the things that you brought up that I thought was a good way of describing the tone of this, because it is more literary, it's not as plot driven, is that it's really trying to impress upon you that, like, grief is real.
Yeah.
And so it's giving you this idea through the idea that you're getting kind of two, I guess you would call them, conflicts. One is that he starts cheating on his wife, or live-in girlfriend, I forget.
I think it's his wife.
Yeah. And that seems to me like a way that he's trying to deal with this, is that, like, he starts this new thing. And he's starting to see like 8-year-old version of himself that, as far as we know, is just like his imagination following him around.
Dressed as a Ninja Turtle.
Dressed
hence,
as, yeah.
Hence the Ninja Turtle mask. Who's always doing, like, kung fu moves.
Right.
And
it's kind of funny because it's like, it's not like the setup of, like, you would say, like, The Kid.
Right.
Where in The Kid, Bruce Willis,
if you haven't seen this gem of a movie.
He is a image consultant that is, like, it's that setup of, like, hey, you're 50 and you're a jerk now.
Yeah.
And so it's just him trying to teach him to behave and act his age and stuff like that. That, too, is tied to trauma that you don't know at the beginning of the movie. But it's played much more as a comedy. With this, it's just kind of like this guy is doing everything but deal with his grief. And 8-year-old version of him just keeps kicking him in the side.
Yeah, it's like,
trying
stop
to
it.
Get him to...
Stop it!
To,
He always pops up when he's making bad choices.
Right. But what I think is cool about this, I wrote the transgressive kid in my notes. It is very much, like, as far as, like, you were saying, the sympathy meter going up and down, how do you think it dealt with the fact that, like, it's not really like they're having conversations. It's pretty much like he's just shutting him down every time he tries to come at him. How do you feel like it dealt with the fact that, like, the kid keeps trying to reach out to him and he's not really giving him anything?
So at first, obviously, I think that's kind of how most people would react. It's like you're seeing what you know is in your head,
right?
Like, you know this is you.
Right.
Arguing with yourself. And the main point of the book is he is not listening to the thing he needs to deal with internally. Even though it affects all of these other relationships around him, the main problem is there is something in himself he needs to face, and he doesn't want to do it. So it pops out as this kid that is trying to get in his face and be like, "Oh, you need to deal with this thing." So if the fact that at first and for most of the beginning and, you know, middle of the book, he is shutting that down makes sense. Like, he doesn't want to deal with it. He's not facing it, just like he's not facing all the other problems he's got. And so it makes, like, it flowed really well as far as you seeing him shut it down, all of a sudden, like, wait, maybe I should listen to some of this. Maybe I need to change some of this.
Right.
Like, what is going on?
It's interesting because we're also binge-watching Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
It's a funny time to be reading this because in some sense, Breaking Bad is about, like, a latent sociopath. And what's interesting is that he gets, in Breaking Bad, Walter White gets cancer, but it kind of plays with the idea at some points in the narrative, like, there had to have been something deeper about his humanity that underlies these actions.
Yeah.
It's not just when you get cancer,
there's something else that was already wrong with him, so that when he was faced with the, oh, you're going to die, then he's like, oh, well, then I guess I'll just be as bad as I want to be and not care.
So, right. So that it's kind of, I think, deeper than other things like it. I've compared it to Mad Men and, like, The Sopranos,
right,
where, like, those shows seem to be unequivocally celebrating this idea of, like, in certain cultures, like, being Italian, or in certain times, like the 60s, there were just these men that you put up with because they were the, like, hot commodities of the time. And they had power and they weren't questioned and whatever. So what this, I think, does very good is that it makes Walter White pathetic, but at the same time, it's dealing with this thing of, like, it's asking you over and over again, are you going to follow this super intelligent guy that's got crept on all his life, do all these terrifying things to those around him just because he finally is getting his, like, all of his delusions of grandeur are now being handed to him. Like, he has this product that is in demand, and that to him is this key to fulfilling his dreams. And he keeps deluding himself. Are you willing to put up with all this stuff to get there? This is a little bit different in the sense that,
He's not in the same position as Walter. Like, Walter White, you know, is brilliant, and you know, had chances to be amazing and lost them. Not necessarily through any fault of his own, right? Like, it was taken from him. This guy had chances to be better than what he was and didn't take them on purpose. Like, he chose to shut his family out. He chose to have this affair with this girl that he knew in high school, that he was with in high school, as a girlfriend also. Like, there were choices he made because of how his brother treated him that made him who he was. So when he's hit with this, he's already pathetic. Like, he's not like this, you know, guy that you might feel sorry for in some sense. You're just like, no, you trashed your life. Like, what are you doing? But I think the main difference between him and Walter White is he still has a conscience that is nagging him. That's what the kid is. The kid is his conscience that is, like, bugging the daylights out of him, like, no, you can fix this. You need to fix this. You need to stop. Walter White doesn't have that.
Right.
There is no conscience in that man. That man, the only thing driving that man is his pride. It's like, no, I am not going to let you take this from me anymore.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because we've been kind of discussing because it was only a year or two ago that I started reading Ernest Hemingway's stuff. And I think what he does a pretty good job of is writing characters that do either do mess up things or have some kind of like underlying pathology or depression or some kind of thing that they're working through. And it just states the facts of what they're doing. It doesn't really go as far as to moralize and say, like, you know, not, it's not like every other character is perfect and this one person is flawed or what have you.
That's another thing I appreciate about this book and about Breaking Bad too. Like, nobody, none of, it's not just like this main character is horrible and the rest of everybody's perfect.
Right.
All the other people have flaws too, which, as you were talking about the sympathy meter, I went up in sympathy eventually for Tony,
mm-hmm.
and then my sympathy for other characters in the story changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I like how the writer did that, like how he hit you with things in the middle of the book that you're like, oh, okay, she's not as innocent as I thought she was,
mm-hmm. right.
or whatever. I think the biggest instance of that was the girl that he's having the affair with.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I was kind of like, because of how she was reacting to him, it felt very much like he was the one who instigated all of it, and it was mostly his fault for talking her into being in this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, no, she's doing it too.
Mm-hmm.
She is purposely trying to draw him back into it, even though he has said he was going to try and stop.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they're messing with each other. It right. wasn't just one side or the other.
And it's interesting as we're talking about it, because it seems like, even though I'm halfway through, we pretty much agree, but we kind of come at it.
I think the stuff you probably haven't gotten to yet is how your sympathy changes for his parents by the end.
Yeah, yeah. You haven't really gotten much of the many humanizing moments with
right.
them yet.
You'll see a lot
it
more of them towards the end.
In the beginning, much more on flashing back to how Karen and him first met. That's the woman that he's having the affair
yeah.
with. And scenes with him and his brother. And I think one thing that I can say about this is that there's an interesting way that some of these what we're calling kind of like literary or specifically literary fiction about transsexual characters is that it's approaching sympathy not by having there be a hero and a villain, and the hero is going to vanquish the villain, and there's that traditional like hero's journey type arc where there's some specific moment of realization within the middle of the book, and then you know
right,
there,
right,
there's
right.
like this you know there's that change over time. I think what you kind of more get is things like you know Nathan and him had four like these floorboards that they try to you know,
oh, yeah,
step
yeah.
on the right one so that
they don't
wake up
their parents
and they sneak out. And so there are all these things that humanize characters that are doing terrible things, and it's that pathos lane rather than the ethos lane of, like, you're going to feel for this character and you're rooting for them to have peace
yeah.
as opposed to, like, the bad guy here is heroin.
Right.
Or the bad girl is Karen because
right.
she's, you know, like using him when he's in this moment of weakness. Rather, there's all these different dynamics set up of, you know, it's not really satisfying to, you know, jump into an affair when, like, it's not really going to fix the problem
right.
of his grief. And in embodying it in this kid, you get this idea of, like, there is something that is nagging at him, and it's more about expressing the journey of grief through this relationship, not fixing everything so it's neat and tidy and,
right.
you know, everybody does the right thing.
This is not a neat and tidy story at all.
No.
Not even remotely.
And I want to talk a little bit about the writing style, because you mentioned it's very stream of consciousness, and there are things so far halfway through that are a little bit nagging in the sense that it's kind of this weird thing where, like, you can, I can tolerate everything in here. There's nothing that, like, offended me.
Yeah, it doesn't, like,
there are certain literary things that it seems like they're trying to make something work, and I don't see the purpose of it. But with this, like, picking stream of consciousness for this character makes sense because he is in this state of constant, like, mental chaos. And so that makes sense in that way. I think that there were just things like doing the tags of, like, and then they said this, and then they said this, within each scene that I'm wondering, is this accomplishing something for this scene? Or is this just the style that he's picked for the whole novel and right. he's throwing it in randomly? So I think that there are specific scenes that I think are, like, elevated in the sense that, like, for example, when he has that scene where he's in the Ninja Turtles costume, it's a flashback, and he's he keeps bugging Nathan to come out of his room, and I'm thinking it's going to set up, oh, he's doing drugs in there or something. Like, that's the dramatic moment that I'm picturing, and then it turns out he opens the door and he says, like, let's go get pizza, or, like, he's willing to play, and he set up that as, like, that had an impact.
Right.
And you're...
Yeah, it's such an interesting relationship. Mm. Like, actually, I wouldn't mind going through several of the relationships Tony has, because they're so very complex and very well shown throughout the whole book. Like, you don't get all of it at once. You get it in pieces, right? Mm. So you get flashbacks of him and his brother. You get flashbacks of him and Karen or him and his parents. And each one gives you a different piece of this relationship, right? The central one, I think, being the one with his brother.
Right.
Because there are times like that you see him worshiping that kid. Like, his brother loves him and wants to go play Ninja Turtles with him, or lets him sneak into his room and play video games at night. There's a couple scenes where it's just, like, you know, stuff a big brother would do for his little brother.
Yeah.
And then there's other scenes where he's being an absolute horrible person. Like, he's the favorite brother, the older one.
Right.
And the parents treat him like he can't do anything wrong.
Right.
So whenever...
Even when there's evidence that he did something, they're trying to kind of brush it
off. To brush it off, and it's no big deal. But if Tony messes up, it's the end of the world, right? Like, it's World War II when he gets punished. Now, part of that might be his perspective on it, because as a kid, you tend to remember it more harshly against yourself.
Right.
Maybe then...
Yeah, and I think you can... You could make the case that there are... That it's somewhat unreliable in the sense that you're getting the scenes that he's picking out.
Right.
And
it's the scenes that, you know, would stick with you most as a kid. So, like, the times when your brother's harshest to you is what you remember, and you might not remember all the best of times.
Right.
Or the times when your parents are harshest to you, if that's what you're trying to hold on to, that's what you remember, right?
And I'll say, to get into a little bit of the parents thing, I think it was good at showing, okay, as younger parents... They're trying, but they're failing in some major ways. And then I think it was very realistic that later on, it's showing that, like the dad likes to tell stories, but they're all just stories. Like, he's not, he's in a conversation with his son, he's not really listening to him. So it's, like, it's interesting how it plays with this, like, they're not cartoonishly evil.
No.
There are things that show that they... Are like trying like
care
like
about
the mom
their
cooks them
yeah.
dinner. Like, it's not like some movie where, like, the parents are also addicted to drugs,
right,
and like,
or like
they're
that.
Trying to paint it like everything that they did is the only reason why their children are like this. It's a little bit more nuanced in the sense that there are certain things that they did to contribute to this problem, and now that Nathan's dead, they're trying to examine themselves for the first time and, like, really admit to themselves what
and
happened.
Both of them, each of them has different reactions to it and treats Tony differently because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so the mom still does stuff like, you know, cook some dinner and
and
things like that, because I think on the mom's side, she's just like, I don't want to lose another son.
Right.
So if that means I have to sit there and argue with him the whole time, that's fine. He's still here.
Right.
As opposed to the dad, who I think just got totally broke. Mm-hmm. He's like, my good son's gone, and this one's worthless, and I don't know what to do with any of that anymore.
Right.
Like, he's totally just shut off. And I think the another main theme of this is the whole shutting out of reality that grief does to you, because grief does that to you. Grief makes you live in, like, that other story you mentioned, the Year of Magical Living, is that what it was called?
Oh, yeah, it was a novel. So Joan Didion wrote this book, and it was basically the story of after her husband passed away. She started recording how reality felt, basically, because there are those things like you might have seen in other movies and TV shows and books where you wake up in the morning and you're expecting your husband to be next to you.
Still there. Are you still, like, there's times I still expect Dad to come home from work, and it's, you know, it's not going to happen. Part of you knows these are things that are never going to happen, but part of you is just so used to these things happening that it's still real to you.
Right.
Right. So there's a lot of that in the story where there's, like, people who are shutting out what is actual reality in favor of what they are so used to being real.
Right.
That's just what their version of reality is right now. And they're just shutting everything else out.
Right.
And
I think it's a compliment to the novel that he's able to capture those things. And, kind of a related thing is that, like, it kind of reminds me of Lost, because it does that flashback thing where it balances the primary A story with contextual flashbacks to inform the different relationships that it's developing.
Right.
And I think it's a very difficult style to try to do if you're going to tell a story, because it can feel like you're taking, you know, two steps forward, one step back, and it's weird to do that rhythmically in a way that feels good.
Right, but I never felt like this didn't flow properly.
Yeah, I thought he did a pretty okay job of that, where it didn't feel like, okay, we're going back to this, because you could have done that in a way that, like, all the flashbacks are idealized,
right?
And it's all it is repeating the same scene over and over again. But he does a good job of, because he's fleshed out all these characters, you get a flashback with Karen that's mostly focused on their relationship, or it's a flashback with Nathan and it mostly focuses on them.
About Karen.
Oh, do you have a thing?
That was the one I think that the sympathies flipped on the most.
Mm.
Like, with the parents, I understood, yes, they're going to have serious issues now, because they already had issues before, and then their son died. So, like, I knew that was going to be a thing. And then for Tony himself, you know, you expect your sympathies to change over the story, because you're expecting him to learn to deal with his grief.
Mm-hmm.
But her, I was expecting, like I said, I thought I was blaming him for that whole thing. And then about a quarter to a third of the way through, I was like, no, you're just as bad. Like, you're not helping.
Uh-huh.
What in the world is wrong with you? Like,
well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because now that you say that, I want to rail against you and, like, stick up for the dude in the thing and, like, and, or not stick up for the dude. What I mean is that, like, the fact that you were at any point sympathetic to her.
Oh, I see. You weren't sympathetic, like, from the beginning.
No, but what's funny is that I didn't really have less sympathy for her than most of the other characters. It just seemed like a kind of skeevy thing to me from the get-go that she was using his parents to kind of stay in the atmosphere. And that it was an interesting thing, because it's like, because I am now 2 years in a relationship, it's weird because, you know, if I could expect all women to hit on me the way that guys do, I could be pretty easily avoid any of those things, because guys are very blunt most of the time about when they're hitting on women. But because I'm starting to think about, like, okay, I'm going to be, there's this girl that I know from high school. She wants to hang out. Does she want to hang out alone in a seedy bar? Or does she want to hang out at, like...
Well, so I assumed Karen was hanging out with his parents, because... So this is a little
different. But I think before you get started, I think that you're right. Nick Gregorio, the author, wants you, I think, to not focus... He's doing a little charlatan work.
Bit.
because, like, it's not like the novel really focuses in the first half on look at how bad Karen's behavior is. But I think it was kind of in the back of my mind reading it in the first half, like, what is her goal in befriending the mom and dad? And I think because that's one of those, like, subconscious, like, fears that I have, it was much more prevalent to me, like, oh, that I don't know, I don't really trust the intentions that she has in befriending his mom and dad. And I felt like he could set up making her less sympathetic later on.
I just thought it was more because she was friends with both brothers and she hung out at the house.
Uh-huh.
That didn't seem as weird to me because, uh-huh, especially since they had lost the one son, like, she would be there just to, you know, help out or whatever. Like, she was there to kind of be a surrogate child to them as
right.
well, because their other son was not
uh-huh.
really in a
but
relationship.
But can you see now
them.
How that could be really...
No, I get that.
Really,
like,
unhealthy.
Once I finally saw how much she was doing to continue their illicit relationship,
uh-huh,
I was like, okay, you know, honey, you're done. Like, this is
well,
wrong.
Yeah, because there's
but, like,
there's two dimensions to it in my mind. One is that as a woman who has a lot of guy friends, I think that, like, you're in this safe space in the game store that you go to, where, like, nobody's gonna question.
No, that
anything
I'm
because you
chilling.
Play a game with them.
Yeah,
you literally throw dice. Like, it's very little trouble that you get into doing that. But, like, that idea of so there's that dynamic of, like, I didn't grow up with a lot of girlfriends that I would go to a different place to hang out with, and so it's just something that, like, just that different context. It was something that I was like, oh, it stood out to me as a novelty. Of, like, why would this girl randomly just come over to hang out with the family if she wasn't interested, like, what, she wants to be their parents' friends?
And, like, to some extent, too, I felt sorry for her because it was, like, at first it seemed very much like the only reason their relationship didn't work was because he fell apart,
hmm,
right? And he decided not to continue it.
Uh-huh.
And so she was kind of like, but I really cared about you kind
uh-huh.
of thing, as opposed to, no, I actually love my husband. I'm just keeping you on the side, which
uh-huh.
is what ended up being the case.
Uh-huh.
Even though she was, I don't know, it gets complicated, and I think
uh-huh.
I appreciate very much how complicated it is, because
right.
it is a complicated thing, but at the same time, it was just like, yeah, I no longer have the sympathy for you that I did, because now I see it as both of your faults that this didn't work, not just his.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she went with somebody else, he went with somebody else, and they should have been, like, that was the choice you made, like, stop
mm-hmm.
trying to, or at least decide that you're not going to stay with the people you're with and decide to go,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, be decisive. Don't do this, like,
right.
wishy-washy nonsense.
But I think
it's happening.
it definitely deals with sexual politics between men and women in that
yeah.
way,
yeah.
that it's much more rewarded for a woman to come into a family and be somebody that is going to try to help comfort everyone, even when
although,
she
I guess
has
that's
history
true.
With this
if,
son.
If it had been a girl's, a daughter's ex-boyfriend that was hanging out with her parents, I would be weirded out by
yes.
that. Much more than
the
it was
standard.
The daughter. No, I understand. I'm sorry. I don't mean it to be a double standard, but it's true.
Right.
I
mean,
see where you're coming from.
I think you could make the case that women are more equipped that way. That, like, they're not just going to normally jump in bed with a guy whose brother just died.
Right.
I think that he's definitely, I think, trying to create a character that is specifically toxic, not just speaking to all women. But I think that a way to kind of summarize that is that she, it's definitely dealing with the double standard of, kind of lost the track.
Ah.
It's about to end.
Okay.
I'm going to collect my thoughts and then we'll be back after the break.
This from the guy that rambles all the time. Sorry. Go ahead.
You can ramble about the topic. That is a lot.
Okay.
I was thinking about a movie called Book of Henry. Why I couldn't think of it because it wasn't. It was a certified tangent, a certified China-approved tangent.
Oh, we have to get your seal approval for tangents now?
Yes, you can file. Just post it at my door. It's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Rules. as long as it's in
triplicate and you get past the panther.
Yeah. I don't know the reference, but I can't wait to read that in this series. Anyway. So in Book of Henry, there's this weird thing where they save a girl from being abused by her father after one of the sons in the nuclear family that has produced Henry. One of the sons dies. Henry notices girl next door is like being abused by her dad, and then it's like, oh no, we're not putting up with that. So before he dies, he sets up this plan of how they can rescue the girl. And then she becomes, they adopt her. But in the very last scene, there's all of these things that they've set up that she did with Henry that now she does with her. It's this very odd Western culture thing of like, kind of like neoliberal reincarnation, where it's like, it's not necessarily like literally reincarnation, but because we've set up this three-act structure thing, there are sometimes payoffs that include very emotional things with new characters, and it's like this redeeming arc, right? I think if you told your therapist that you now do all these things with the new kid, they would probably think, okay, we're going to need to unpack this over the next five sessions. And so,
well, I mean, it depends on what it likewise, is. If it's just stuff that you, in general, had always intended to do with your children, and this is now your child.
It's a discussion.
Okay.
I'm trying to make the case.
Sorry.
That if it's something with Karen being this, from the goodness of her heart, I think you can make the case that is a messy thing. It's not necessarily that he's trying to say anybody that's trying to be sympathetic to somebody who is going through a tough time is out for this kind of weird, like, manipulation tactic. But I think it's something to discuss about, like, if you're, you know, if you're in love with someone and somebody close to them dies, and they're with somebody, that's not the time that you approach them to start a relationship.
No.
So, like, I think that that's the thing that, like, it's just a strange, it's a thing about, and it's specifically, like, with the first example, with the Book of Henry situation, because it is a mom, it's something that I think as a society we don't look at as closely as being pathological, because there is this sentimental veneer over it. And because that is this heightened thing where it's trying to make, like, this case that, like, Henry was, because of the quality of child that Henry was, he had this plan set up of, like, this is how we're going to rescue this girl. So maybe it's fulfilling more his wishes than some weird fixation that she had. So it's not as... It's not trying to make the case that, like, the way that you solve your depression is you adopt another child and you pretend like they're
the first child.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of the conversation, is that, like, you know, not like, I think that they're trying to get at with this is that, I think, Mr. Gregorio is trying to show that, like, there are ways that there are different, like, coping mechanisms that start to go into effect when you lose somebody close to you. And he's trying to show the kind of balance between immediately, you know, sacrificing one relationship for another just because you're feeling broken.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a good guy, bad guy thing of, like, in order to make the reader feel better, we're going to create this horrible caricature of a manipulator in order to give them some kind of, like, unearned catharsis. It's really more so, like, yeah, when you're broken in half by something like this, you're going to do some messed up stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's more setting up that that's one of those things that happens. You might meet somebody that may be just as broken as you, and they're going to be willing to sacrifice their relationship in order to make you feel better, because sometimes there are people that are willing to do that, willing to, whether it's like a savior complex or whatever, get into those things.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way to put what Karen had. It's kind of like this, I'm here to make everybody feel better, or whatever that means. Mm. So, like, yes, I will go be the good child for your parents because their good child died, and right. I will come and be your, you know, please you however you want to be. I mean, not that it didn't please her too, but, like, you know, if that's what's going to make you feel better right now, then fine.
Right.
Like, that's kind of how, where she was.
Yeah. And I think we just don't get, because it's difficult to do, because you get into that conversation of slut shaming. You get into the conversation of, well, so what, we can't have, you know, it's, I guess some versions of that with a savior complex, you get into the argument of, like, women filling in like a more strong female protagonist role or something.
But I was just trying to figure out, like, other than just using him for a relationship like that, mm-hmm. using him for sex, basically,
uh-huh.
what else she was getting out of it, because he wasn't treating her very well. It's not like they had a real relationship,
and
she knew that,
mm-hmm.
and was continuing it, knowing that. Like, that was a conscious choice on her part.
Right.
It wasn't like she thought they were going to run off together. She was just like, no, we're just having this thing.
I think that's the main difference in perspective, is that even though I wasn't necessarily, like, hating her, I was thinking, Tony is not a prize to be won.
No.
So it's, like, it's strange to me that she would have this, you know, attitude toward him. And
I mean, other than thinking, because I think they do at some point say that they were both each other's first love.
Right. I think that's...
Which is a strong thing.
Uh-huh.
Especially when you share grief the way they are sharing grief. So that like you said, it's a messy thing.
right.
It's a big, messy, complicated.
Yeah, and to that point, it's kind of playing on that idea of nostalgia. It's not just nostalgia in terms of Nathan and his relationship, and the idea of, like, he has, like, it mentions a couple different times, like, you know, watching old TV shows and stuff like that. I think it does well to talk about those things. But it's not just that, and you would get in something like The Kid, where it's this, like, Disney movie, and they're trying to
more broadly talk about that kind of thing. This is down and dirty, nitty gritty. This is what happens when you're in pain like this.
Yeah, they start romanticizing the fact that they had this high school relationship.
Right, and they're trying to go back to this ideal.
Right.
Thing so that even, actually, when you have some flashbacks, really wasn't that ideal.
Yeah,
but still. This time when everything was better,
right.
Let's go back to that.
Yeah,
which is when I want to bring up Chris? His friend Chris?
Oh, yeah. I haven't gotten much to him, so
Chris
have a field
is
day.
Awesome. So, at first, you kind of... You're not really... Like you said, he's not there much.
Uh-huh.
But he is there. And he is the only one that is consistently there.
Mm.
And later
it's
on...
It's so funny to me that, like, he's the one that spills the beans about Karen being...
Yeah.
So I wasn't... Because, like we've said, he's not a major character. It's so interesting because I'm not sure whether that's supposed to set up that he is trying to undercut him in some way. But, like, the more that I read it, the more it just seems like he's just his doofy friend.
No, he's just his doofy friend who's just like, this is the truth. And
yeah.
I just say the truth, whether you're ready to hear the truth or not.
Right.
So this is how it is. And that's he does
nice.
That through the whole book. And he does it because he loves his friend, right? Like,
right.
He is really Tony's friend.
Right.
Most of the other people in this book, Tony has cut out in some way. And he kind of tries to cut Chris out, too. But Chris is just, like, either clueless about it or doesn't care, right? He's just like, whatever, man. Like, that's how their general relationship is described. Whatever, man. Like, let's just go. Because at some point, I don't want to spoil too much for you, but at some point, his dad runs away.
Oh, okay.
And Chris goes with Tony to go find his dad. Oh, so there's this huge, long, really boring road trip where they're living on, like, caffeine and beer and cigarettes.
Boring for the characters.
Boring for the characters.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't boring for me, but where they're trying to chase his father down. And Chris is willing to go with him. But at some point, Chris is like, dude, you need to stop now. Mm. Can we go home? Like,
right.
Because that's just how Chris is. Chris is like, okay, look, that's enough. Like, I'm just going to tell you the truth because that's how I am.
Mm-hmm.
So Chris, I thought, was a really cool character because I'm not saying, like, he's perfect. He's not. Mm. He's doofy, like you said.
Yeah.
But he's the one guy that's, like, the most consistent person that I was just like, oh, yeah, cool. That's, like, Tony's actual friend.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have a friend,
and
Tony.
I think
good job.
It's good that you brought him up because now that I'm thinking about it, I think with him and with Mara, who is Tony's wife, you get this
See,
idea
I didn't
of
even
like
remember to bring her up, which is terrible because
it's funny because even though she is more passive, that I think that more or less sets up that like his commentary with Karen is not all women because you get like Chris has this, like you said, a very blunt way of trying to help him through it. And I would argue like that's the masculine way of trying to deal with this. It's like, you need to just speak the truth until the pain is less. As opposed to with Mara, it's a little bit more like she's trying to balance this like, I need to be high maintenance with you need to be a man.
Yeah.
And this idea of like, I'm here for you if you need me. So like there's this interesting thing where it's like, you are sympathetic with her because she's had to put up with him being not communicative and trying to improve the relationship and trying to do the best to like create like a potential good father or something down the line and all that stuff. But and is like, you know, saying like, you know, how are you feeling and checking up on him and stuff. But you don't get this idea that like it's this provincial like caricature of like this is the what we get into with her and Karen, this idea of like the whore and Madonna thing. And
well, I don't think it's quite that.
No, but that's my point.
Yeah.
Is that usually if you're doing this like you can make this example for a lot of different things, they romanticize the whore and they like one or the other.
Right.
You get one where it's like this provincial person is the paragon of existence and this person is a slut. Or the reverse, you get this like, you know, this promiscuous person represents freedom and the person that this person is married to is, you kind of get that a little bit in Fahrenheit 451. It's
one of the
things that rereading it now as an adult seemed kind of odd because you get this painting of the wife as this nagging person and then he meets this young woman and reading it as an adult, I'm just like, this is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know what this says about that particular portrayal of women.
Right.
Is that like a young woman who is still has her eyes wide open,
right,
and it's like this all knowing being.
The manic pixie dream girl of Fahrenheit.
Right. So that, yeah. So like, he could have easily written it either of those ways, but I'll give it the credit of while it is a literary thing and it has this like style of like, what do you call it? Stream of consciousness. It's not with the relationships. It's not trying to float above the reader,
right,
in the sense that like, you know, it's not trying to write like, you know, like, he could have gone super autobiographical about it and made it, like, so unrelatable that way so that you would have had to be in his family to understand what's going on. Or it could have been some lofty writerly thing where he's throwing references at you and trying to prove how smart he is.
Did Mara even, like, which is terrible because now that it's been, it took me a long time to read it, not because it was bad, it's because I kept losing the book. Because my car eats things. But anyway.
It is safe and sound near now.
It is safe and sound now in John's hands because John doesn't let my car eat his books. But did she even like try to get to him? To get to Tony?
Mara? I mean, and like there's a scene earlier on in the diner where he's trying to say, like, why aren't you, like, yelling at me? And I think it's pretty realistic that she's like, listen, like,
I'm an adult and you're an adult. How about you be an adult? That's like, right. The opinion
so,
I
like,
think
she's
of her.
Trying to balance the fact that, like, I have the utmost sympathy for you now. And I get that this is horrible what happened to you. But also, you've been on probation before at your job. And it's like, it's kind of like what we discussed with Skyler and Walter White. Like, there's a situation where someone has gone through something earth-shattering, but you have this dynamic, you have this relationship, and you're trying to work on this as, like, specifically with Walter White, it's like, you're a father, and you're treating us like crap,
yeah.
Because you're going through something. With this, it's a little bit different, because they don't have a kid to,
right.
Like, protect in that way, so it's more about, like, they just have this relationship, and I'm giving it the credit of, like, it feels lived in that way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That she doesn't want to worship the ground that he walks on. He's like, she's like real with him. But at the same time, like, she's trying to balance that with, like, I need to give him some, like, rope because of what just happened. So I think that, like, I think maybe you could make the case that it is more, she is more of a passive character than others, maybe.
But I'm trying to decide if I thought she was being passive because she already had started not to care as much for him.
Uh-huh.
Or if it was more, that's just the way she was. Like, if that was her personality, and he had started a relationship with her knowing that was her personality, that she wasn't the kind that was going to fight back or you know, get really angry and upset with him when he
right.
gets angry and upset.
Yeah, I see your point.
Like, because usually, if you really care about somebody and they're acting like that, you will react strongly because you care about them, not because you hate them, but because it hurts you to see them being that way.
Uh-huh.
And you would think a wife that cared about somebody would do that, would, like, try, would get angry, would
right.
do something. But, like, I felt very much like that she just kind of was like, I'm done with you. Like, you don't know how to act like the adult man I need to be in a relationship with,
uh-huh.
so I'm just going to let you do your thing.
Uh-huh. Well, I can say from 2 years of being in a relationship that there are those specific junctures where, like, where specifically my girlfriend Megan will be forward about something specific where it's like there needs to be, I need to understand where you sit in this lane that we're talking about, but the. I think it's an interesting thing about, and it's another, I think it's good to bring up because it's another kind of sexual politics thing that this novel deals with, in that she's making it pretty easy for him to cheat on her at the beginning. And so you can fall on the side of like we were talking about with Breaking Bad, why isn't this person just saying he makes meth?
Yeah.
That's why your dad's like this, he's
right.
making meth.
Right.
Versus, I've committed to be in a relationship with this person, and so as I'm going to go the extra mile and be, you know, self-sacrificial in caring for them, because maybe if I do that, just that extra step, they'll be like, wait, this person actually loves me. Why don't
right.
I get my act together and understand that? But I think you could definitely have that conversation, and I think Nick wants us to have that, is that, like, what, when somebody's going through something like this, do you just make them casseroles, or do you lock them in a room and say, like, we need to talk
right.
about this because
right.
you're not, something is wrong. You're not dealing with this the way that you, should be.
I'll be interesting to hear your take on the ending. I don't want to spoil the ending for you because it's not what I expected it to be. Which is a good thing. Not saying that it was, like, unsatisfying. It was a very satisfying ending. But it was not exactly how I expected it to go.
Right.
Just to see what you think of how it ends and the resolution, because it's pretty cool.
Well, before our final thoughts, I wanted to talk about, like, the one thing that I feel positive about this podcast is that we haven't picked a specific medium, a specific genre, and when you pick this book up, it being at a general bookseller's convention where there was, like, an author alley, what did you expect it to be, and then what?
So
how did I meet those expectations?
So I will not lie. We went to this guy's table because he had Ninja Turtles action figures on his table. I was like, oh, cool. What's with the Ninja Turtles? And he's like, well, there's a kid. There's a guy in my book who sees a younger version of himself dressed as a Ninja Turtle. He has this, like, apparition that's bugging him. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like a cool story. And then I realized, and looking at the other stuff that was available, like, at his table and the neighboring table that they were, like, kind of partnered with, the other table did, like, a literary magazine that was about magical realism and stuff.
Right.
I was expecting it to be literary in nature just because of how they talked about it.
Uh-huh.
I was like, okay, I know what I'm getting into with this one.
Right.
And I could tell also, like you were saying, from the covers that these were very, I mean, it's a very good cover, but you can tell it's still a very literary fiction cover, as opposed to the guy three tables down that you we knew from three blocks away was a fantasy author.
Right.
Like, and the historical fiction chicks across the way, like, you could just tell anymore, kind of. If you're, like, a big genre like that, you can...
Yeah.
It screams it.
Cover conventions that you're like, yeah, I know what this is.
So, yeah, so I was kind of expecting this literary sort of thing. I was not expecting the in-depth look at grief that we got, which I think was very impressive.
Yeah, and I think that it's to me what I'm hoping a certain lane of literary fiction, maybe not the only thing that gets published under that kind of loose like genre, but it's something that I enjoy about this one specifically, that it has that hook where, okay, you see the Ninja Turtles mask and you think, okay, this is about... And you like the two images, the cigarette and the Ninja Turtles mask, you're seeing, oh, this is about, like, growing up.
Right.
And so it's specifically, you could talk about it in that, and now it's transgressive, and that, like, this person, cheating on their wife and, you know, drinking themselves to death and stuff like that. But it's not as abrasive as that. It's not trying to be Fight Club or American Psycho. It's not just trying to
it's
shock you.
It's definitely looking at coping mechanisms.
Right.
This is what this guy is doing to cope.
And so I appreciate that it's using... He has that hook of the Ninja Turtles little version of Tony.
Yeah.
But it wasn't trying to make... I think it earned that as, like, a magical realism device.
Yeah, because that was the only real... not even supernatural, it's the wrong word. But you're right, like, magical.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's not magical realism in the sense
thing.
That, like, if
nobody
it were,
else could see it. Like,
yeah,
if
it were, other
it
people would see it and then acknowledge it and then not be weird.
Yeah.
But it's magical realism in the sense that, like, everything is realistic and contemporary and everything. But this one character is hallucinating, basically.
Hallucinating
his young self. So it's using that as a device. And so I like that there are this breed of high concept literary pieces that can deal with, like you were saying, 80s nostalgia, and using that kind of mechanism of talking about something. Like, we could kind of put Arrival in that lane. You know, Ted Chiang is using cultural linchpins like Aliens and the Tower of Babel,
but to discuss real deep emotional.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's a name for that. We've kind of bandied around visionary fiction because there are some things like that that are in that neighborhood.
High concept, maybe, is another.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's a couple different writerly and marketing words for that.
Buzzword.
But yeah, I thought it was a good entry. I think that it kind of bugs me that there are so many typos in it.
Yeah.
I think that I would not blame anyone specifically for that, specifically because I did not work on the book. So I'm not saying that to be on my high horse. I have typos in my book that is on Amazon. But I think that the kind of the emotional reaction was less, this is something that's turning me off to the book, and more, I wish that this type of stuff
was more of the stuff, and that people loved it as much as it deserves.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it's certainly something that
I would watch this movie. I'll tell you that.
Oh yeah. I think Nick Gregorio deserves praise for this, and in the sense that he's it's very mature. it's very well handled in the style of it. And I think it's something you, like, you should look out for more stuff from this guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's nice to go to, like, an event like this and find something where you respond to it, and it's like, I'll remember this book a few years from now. Like, that it's not every day that you go to a local thing and there's somebody just, you know, whether it's an indie press thing like this from Maudlin House, or it's somebody self-published, you know, their thing. It's not often that that gets into the same mental headspace as, you know, some of the classics like that I celebrate all the time, like Hemingway and stuff. And he definitely sets himself up in
the beginning
of, like, when you
he does
drop,
that all the way through.
When
starts
you drop
names.
Hemingway and Faulkner, it's like, I see you.
I see where you go with
this. I see
this.
You trying
see
to
what
do
you
this.
Got.
Okay. But yeah, and another thing, Nick was very nice on Twitter. I was very cheeky about one of his lines, because he has a line that's in a love scene that is, like, rhyming. And so I did a cute little, like, Dr. Seuss post.
I missed that tweet.
He was very good humored about it and didn't take offense to it.
Thank you for being a cool dude, Nick.
That's to his
credit.
Nice
to meet you. So we're hoping to do more local author reviews, discussions, whatever we call these things.
Yeah, because, like, we've
not really reviews.
Kind of been hit or miss in terms of, like, making giving anything, like, a name, per se. Because, like, I think some people just see the word book and they're like, you know, they those things that they used to force people to read.
Those rectangular, horrible things
but, like,
we had to do at school.
We want
to
keep these to be, like, informal talks about them and not feel like we need to hit every plot point and everything and do an in-depth, you know, literary analysis.
No, but we're talking more about what we like about the story.
And certainly because we're taking this opportunity over the next year to go to a lot of local places, we're certainly going to be looking out for people's work.
I already have a pile of stuff.
Yes.
Because after this, I'm reading...
Misha went ham.
I'm reading The Thief of All Light, and I forget the author's name, which is terrible because I follow him on Instagram and everything. Bernard...
Schaefer.
Bernard Schaefer.
Yes. I'm going through the Kronos Principle?
Is it the Kronos
I believe
Principle?
It's what it's called.
Oh, the dudes we met at Wizard World.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were cool dudes, too.
Yes.
They were all cool dudes. So far, all the authors we've met have been awesome people, and I look forward to talking about their stuff and maybe meeting them again in the future. Bernard Schaefer has a book launch coming up that I was going to hope to make it to. So, we shall see.
I'm not sure if Kronos Principle was the name of it, but...
Kronos is in the title. I do remember that.
Yes. But I'll talk about that later, even if it's just a segment on another show.
Yeah.
But that one is a time travel sci-fi book, and they were both, like, it's nice to see sci-fi authors like that excited about sci-fi and trying to get other people out there. They did a writing panel at Wizard World.
And they were very nice in offering publishing advice to new authors. So I might hit them up for advice. At some point,
right.
See how they are.
A minute ago, we're going to let you know at Unboxing Story, Twitter, Facebook, and
UnboxingStoryPodcast@gmail.com.
Or if you go to our Unboxing Story page on Anchor, you can leave us a voicemail.
Yeah.
We'd love to feature you on the show.
Call us.
And field your questions. All right. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.